From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, Political Violence in the Middle East. This topic concludes a series of Soundings discussions about the historical origins of social unrest in the modern world. My guests are Jerry Levin and Sis Levin, two people who have experienced political violence firsthand. Jerry Levin served as bureau chief of the cable news network in Beirut, where he was kidnapped and held hostage for 11 months. He made his way to freedom in the Bekaa Valley in February 1985. According to Jerry Levin, much of the credit for his freedom from captivity goes to his wife, Sis Levin, who lobbied with politicians, military, and cultural leaders in the United States, Lebanon, and Syria. At the time the following Soundings discussion was taped, 5 U.S. citizens remained in political captivity in the Middle East. According to Jerry Levin and Sis Levin, these men are pawns in a battle of silence and pride waged by American and Middle Eastern participants. Who are the hostages? Why are they being held? Do people know about them? What should they know? There's a lot of things you could talk about.
Well, who are they? Primarily, they're the ones who have now been dubbed the forgotten hostages, which puts them in a very special category. Their names are Bill Buckley, who we feel probably is dead from the evidence, and I'll come back to that. Bill was a political officer at the U.S. Embassy in Beirut, and he was kidnapped March 16, 1984. Then there's Father Lawrence Martin Jinko, who is a Catholic priest who almost certainly is alive. Our evidence is that he is alive, and there's a fairly recent letter from him to his family. Terry Anderson, Chief Associated Press Middle East correspondent. David Jacobson, manager of the University of Beirut Hospital, and Tom Sutherland, dean of the American University School of Agriculture.
Why are these people being held? Are there specific reasons unique in each case, or can you generalize about them?
No, there is a specific reason that they are held. They are held together for one specific reason, which has been very clear for quite some time, and that is for exchange for 17 Shiite fundamentalist prisoners being held in Kuwait for the bombing of the French and American embassies in Kuwait.
And why can't we not have an exchange? What's the problem?
The problem simply is that our policy in America is no deal, no exchange. No negotiation with terrorists.
Sis Levin and Jerry Levin. Jerry, tell us very briefly, we have limited time, what happened to you?
Well, the way in which I got out was a twofold process, building up the courage to take advantage of my captors' sloppiness. Occasionally they were careless with the chain, which they bound me to the wall.
Just very briefly, you were held for exactly how long?
11 and a half months. And the first few times that the opportunity to leave arose, I finally shrunk back because I didn't know enough about the situation, my captors' movements, where I was. In the last house, when this took place, I knew more about my situation. I knew more that my captors didn't come in the room except to give me meals and to take me to the bathroom once or twice a day, and then they didn't come back. In this house, I was able to, I knew more where I was and where I wanted to go. When I would sneak looks out the windows, which I wasn't supposed to do. So that in the last house, it was no longer a matter of courage. I was to do it. I was scared stiff when I finally went through with it. But I wasn't afraid to try it this last time because I finally had to decide. I finally decided you may never get a better chance, and then you're foolish if you don't.
And you ended up scrambling down a mountain in the middle of the
night. That's right. I tied 3 blankets together and put them out the window and tied them to a railing and went down and then snuck down the mountainside. And I, within a couple of hours, I fell into a hand of a Syrian army patrol. But in talking about my escape, you can't talk about it as a single action, just my actions, because as soon as I got out, it became very, very clear that, excuse me, as soon as I got out, it became very, very clear that Sis played an important role, a key pivotal role in it, because she had spent the entire month of November in Damascus, consciousness raising there, and she'll tell you more about that, creating a climate in which, when I fell into the Syrian Army Patrol hand, there was no question in my mind, mm-hmm. once they understood who I was, that I was going to go free.
Mm-hmm. Sis, do you think that he was let go? I mean,
yes.
Have you ever figured that out? Tell me what you...
No, I've always and consistently thought that he was let go. Mm-hmm. There was a plan afoot for his release, which I was only a participant in. I'd love to take all the bows. I was guided by a scholar, as a matter of fact, Dr. Landrum Bowling, mm-hmm. Who was a former president of the Quaker University, Earlham, and who wrote a classic book, Search for Peace in the Middle East, about 25 years ago. Dr. Bowling is one of those rare people who is able to move about among the differing factions in the Middle East, and he's trusted. He understands all points of view, and he's a mediator and is attempting to reach a solution for peace in the Middle East. Dr. Bowling saw Syria as the key to the problem. Now, you may be looking at me like, what problem? The hostage problem or the peace problem?
Well, not only that, but the fact that he was being held in Lebanon, and Syria is, as you say, or somehow or other acts as a key in all of that.
I'm glad you mentioned that. The thrust of the search for the hostages, almost universally by those trying to find them, concentrated on Beirut.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Bowling felt, again, that Syria was the key. We had many clues. We had much help from the Muslim community. And this is unusual. Again, here is a Jewish man with a Christian wife being helped by the Muslim community. People who cared, who were searching for him, the street talk, the collection of information was that they were being held in the Bakaa Valley.
Uh-huh.
The Bakaa is under Syrian control.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, we could have searched every square inch of Beirut and never come up with answers, at least to the where they
mm-hmm.
were.
Mm-hmm.
So Dr. Bowling took me to Syria and requested the help of his friend, President Assad.
What kind of, what was the process like, Sis Levin, when you were trying to find Jerry and worrying about him and praying over him? What kind of response did you get from the United States government?
It was very stonewalling. I always tried to see it from their point of view.
People just didn't want to talk to you.
I never heard from the American embassy in Beirut.
Amazing.
When Jerry was kidnapped, I remained in Beirut for at least 10 days. The British came running, a contingency from the British embassy, and met many needs, just the most humane kinds of needs. Saw to it that someone stayed with me, you know, because I was alone, a woman in Beirut, and I hadn't been there very long, and it was a very overwhelming experience, but they were there for me. I simply never heard from the American embassy. When I finally got to Washington and began to pound on doors in the State Department, the information was extremely limited. We have reason to believe he's alive and well. I came to find out finally they weren't even looking in the right place, so their information was extremely limited. I feel now, and I felt early on, that it was quite counterproductive
uh-huh.
that we did not become partners in the search for Jerry.
Do you feel, Sis Levin, are you, what, entirely cynical? Do you think that absolutely nothing was being done, or that in fact there were efforts and steps being made and taken that somehow were kept from you for, what, politically, ideologically expedient reasons? Tease that out for me.
I'm of two minds about it. The State Department is not a monolithic structure.
Mm-hmm. Like the Middle East.
There were people there I'm extremely fond of. They meant the best. Their motivation was the strongest, and I believed them.
Mm-hmm.
There was paper from the floor to the ceiling on the problem. Looking back on it and thinking about all those hours and all that paperwork, and they weren't even looking in the right place, I'm greatly concerned.
Mm-hmm.
you know, about what their resources are, and are they being misled?
Mm-hmm.
All that being said, there is a point of view about this particular problem that it is not, it would appear not in a certain faction's best interests for these particular hostages to be out.
Mm-hmm.
The assumption is that these men who were in service in the Lebanon, who were particularly aware of the sensitive issues in the Middle East, were understanding. I'm no longer using the word sympathetic because there's too much connotation about taking sides,
mm-hmm.
Were at least comprehending and understanding the situation there and insisting on the fact that that story be told as a whole story,
mm-hmm.
and not in a narrow context,
mm-hmm.
that perhaps it would not be best for those of a narrow context to have them free and have them as a group,
mm-hmm.
Making a plea for hearing and telling the whole story. That would not be comfortable for the narrow context people.
Jerry Levin, let me draw you into the conversation from a retrospective position. What would you tell the State Department about how to handle, for example, a problem as specific, an experience as specific as the one that you went through? If you could write the policies, if you could make the suggestions and get the ear of the people who can do things when incidents like this occur, what would you say?
Well, I don't think you can ever say blanket what should be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I asked you, for example, about your situation.
Right. In this case, it's quite clear that because of our policy, no negotiations, no deal, the administration was painted into a corner of its own choosing, and it has chosen to stay into. They have publicly said that they will not countenance any kind of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
They won't negotiate. They won't make concessions. And in a sense, that has consigned these hostages to a continued captivity, and with the bombing of Libya, the beginning of their executions and their sacrifice. The question is, has their sacrifice any value? Mm-hmm. From where I sit, their sacrifice has been valueless. It is achieving nothing in the war on terrorism. One of the main arguments that has been used in the case of these hostages, that if an accommodation was reached that would somehow mean the deportation from Kuwait of the prisoners being held there, in which we were being held in exchange for, that this would be the incentive for future acts of terrorism,
mm-hmm.
future hostage taking, future exchanges, and therefore that we couldn't have any part of it. And a great deal of agonized thinking, and it has gone into the government's position on that. Well, especially with the bombing of Libya, it's quite clear that these hostages are being held captive to, in a sense, a discriminatory policy, because apparently the administration ruled out in the decision to bomb Libya the problem of reprisals, because it had to be perfectly obvious to a kindergarten or a first grader that if we did what we did in Libya, there were going to be reprisals. And probably the first people that would bear the brunt of it would be hostages. And that is indeed what happened. Our feeling, so in a sense, Libya was the families of the hostages' worst nightmare coming true.
This is why Sis said earlier that it's almost certain that Mr. Buckley has been killed.
Well, Mr. Buckley was killed, actually, before that, but uh-huh. for the same reason. The
uh-huh.
captors said, whether Buckley actually was killed for that reason or not, the captors said that Buckley was executed because our support of Israel's bombing raid on Tunis, which was the previous October. So they used the same reason for doing it. Our feeling was that if what everybody felt was inevitable was an inexorable move by our government towards a violent escalation of our war on terrorism, whether that's appropriate or not, if that was the case, that our government should have done everything that it could
mm-hmm.
to get those hostages out of the line of fire, but it didn't. And to still cling to the idea that this is what would cause future acts of terrorism, as I say, is grossly unfair. While they've been held hostage and no exchange was even taking place, more terrorist incidents, more hostage taking, more executions, more murders and explosions have taken place against Americans and Westerners than ever before. So it's quite clear that these captors don't need that specific type of victory, let us say, to as an incentive to continue their acts of terrorism. It's the deep-seated sociological and political grievances.
Mm-hmm. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You're listening to the concluding segment in a series of discussions about the origins of social unrest in the modern world. The topic at hand is Lebanon and the Middle East. My guests are Jerry Levin and Sis Levin. Jerry Levin served as bureau chief of the cable news network in Beirut, where he was kidnapped and held hostage for 11 months. He made his way to freedom in February 1985. Jerry Levin and Sis Levin, our topic is the Middle East, Lebanon, terrorism, hostage-taking, kidnapping. Jerry has been through this personally. Sis, what are you doing now? You have just, at the time we're doing this taping session, you have just returned from the Middle East, and you plan another trip in, what, 5 or 6 months. Do you feel like a voice in the wilderness? Are people listening? Who are they? What's going on?
Well, I take encouragement from whatever source I can get it. Most recently, it's coming from women, and I'm very happy about that. When Jerry was missing and I went back to the Middle East, I found women, just like women in America, who were extremely concerned about what looked like the path toward war, the unavoidable path toward war, who were worried about their sons. And were also concerned about raising children under such traumatic conditions. You see, just everyone's thinking is so completely locked in to one point of view. In America, we're the cowboys, they're the Indians, but you see over there, it's just the reverse. Mm-hmm. The communication is down, the bridges are out. They feel as totally justified in their own situation for hostility toward us as we do toward them.
What should they know about Americans? What should we know about them? That's an immense question, of course, but where would you begin?
Well, I did begin just by going, and I am an American. I do not want war. I do not think that retaliation is a path to peace. The alternative to peace is war, and I don't think that the threatening rhetoric coming out of our country mm-hmm. has any chance of communicating solutions to the problem and avoiding war.
Let me argue with you for a moment. Maybe
sure.
Are we overlooking a third or a fourth alternative? One, if we don't have peace and we don't have war, we have what we have now. Now, some people could characterize what we have now as a form of warfare, but at least we don't have thousands of young men going in both directions. How do we get off the dime so that we are headed toward what you would characterize as a peaceful solution?
The only way I know to get off the dime is to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's so frightening to me about our position in this country. We will not talk to them is the current policy.
Do you mean in the form of our political leaders talking to theirs? Are you talking about, not to trivialize, I don't mean that for an instant, but people such as yourself going there and meeting second, third, fourth level cultural and political types? How be specific for
All
me
right.
in
well,
this process.
Well, there's very little of that going on. As I anticipated going back, and I began to choose a team to go with me. A lot of women wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed important to have people across the boards, people at high level. I asked two friends who are cabinet wives. Neither cabinet wife was allowed to go, and the rationale given them was not it's dangerous, because this is in the early stages. You know, this was before the bombing of Libya.
Mm-hmm.
They were told categorically at the administrative level, you can't go because Assad is speaking to Gaddafi. Mm-hmm. I thought it was probably a pretty good idea that Assad speak to Gaddafi. I think it's always a good idea that people speak to people.
Well, how in the world would your being there or the cabinet wives interfere with that? That would appear to be a reinforcement toward a positive end. Am I being naive here? What?
Well, what I'm trying to express to you is that the policy, which I think goes under the broad title of quiet diplomacy, means that...
That's too visible.
That we only, you know, we only talk under the table, and we don't... If a country philosophically is out of step, you know, with our policy, then we don't speak to them.
Mm-hmm. What about a leadership being out of step with a country? Do you think, are people in this country as ignorant as we can only assume they are about the cultures and religions and politics of the Middle East? If they're not that ignorant, surely they must be talking to the American leadership and urging some changes. What's going on there?
I don't, you know, it used to be when I was suffering terribly trying to get people's attention about the hostages, that the two answers were, they don't know or they don't care. And those are pretty terrible choices to have to make. So I prefer to think they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's far away and it doesn't affect my life and I don't know. And I would say, it isn't going to go away and it is going to affect your life, and we could have a little, you know, preventative thinking here, mm-hmm, if we could just, you know, get a sense of urgency in the American public. The fact, going back to the performance of the debates, here are the two presidential candidates not feeling any necessity to discuss the Middle East in a foreign policy debate speaks volumes. The people didn't need to know about the Middle East. It wasn't high on the agenda. And that's very frightening to me.
Mm-hmm.
We're concentrating in other areas, and our thinking is not going that way now. Now you tell me, do we not know? Do we not care? I just hate the word ignorant. I think we would say ourselves. I've only been involved for 3 years. Before I went to the Middle East, it wasn't high on my consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I was ignorant. I just simply didn't know anything about
it. It affected
you
personally, and that's what moved you.
Now, you know, it's mm-hmm. it's an obsession with me. So the answer to that, I suppose, is you have to go.
Right.
At least in your mind, in your spirit, you have to go.
Jerry Levin from Cable News Network and Sis Levin. Our topic is the Middle East, social unrest, terrorism, kidnapping. Let's conclude our conversation. What would you tell a general audience? Do you have a sort of theme that you would touch upon by way of turning this ignorance or indifference around in this country? Jerry, let me begin with you.
Well, in terms of talking to the general audience, I am still very much concerned about the fate of those Americans still being held hostage over there.
Does that hold you back from saying some of the things that you would say?
No. No,
okay.
Was to answer your question. In terms of what I want to say to the general audience is, they need to be concerned about those hostages in a way they haven't been before. Apparently, the 5 or 6 that are still left are not enough. Certainly not enough to motivate the administration to do any and everything to get them free, even the hard things. And the American people apparently don't feel, apparently have not felt the same urgency as they did in the case of the Flight 847 hostages, yeah, as they did in the case of Achille Lauro, in the case of Iran.
You remind me of a line from a Dylan Thomas poem, "After the first death, there is no other." What do we got to have 1,000 people held rather than just 2? Is that what you're telling me?
Well,
5 or 6?
I think that's essentially what the administration is counting on. This is a problem for it that it does not want to come to grips with in a way that would ensure those hostages coming home.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're counting on the fact that there aren't enough for the people really to be aroused in such a way that they might convey to their congressman and to the administration itself, you've got to get them out.
I think the administration is not going to, the politicians are not going to respond to a need that they don't hear loudly expressed enough.
Absolutely, because you know, the consequences are such that they would just assume not, because mm-hmm. there is an element of losing faith here.
Mm-hmm.
Our problem is that the arguments they're using, I don't think are fair. In a sense, they're discriminatory
mm-hmm.
to say that some kind of an accommodation would encourage future acts of terrorism and endanger future American lives, when, in, as I said earlier, with the bombing of Libya, they put American lives in jeopardy there, but they didn't hesitate to take the violent approach. Mm-hmm. This case, it would be approach to stop the execution of these hostages.
Sis?
If I just have a moment left, my deepest concern at this point is the failure of the serious Christian to address the problem. Having lived there and having loved the place and the people, I saw the basic conflict, which this hostage taking is only a representation of, as being the people of the book. Here were the Israelis, here were the Muslims. Their book, the heavy, heavy emphasis is on justice. They both are outraged that the rights and the right to justice each have is in conflict, and both felt totally justified in their position of hostility, and both make a very good case talking about justice. The Christian, I think, adds another dimension to that. The Christian says that his belief is based on mercy. The cross is about where mercy meets justice. The Christian actually is the middle child, in a sense. You know, the Judaic tradition predates us, and the Islamic tradition follows us. So this difficult middle child who could say, "Now, wait a minute, fellas, you're both talking about your rights. Let us tell you about a man who laid down his rights, who hung on a cross and said, let me teach you about forgiveness. Let's start from that place." And the serious Christian who says he believes this, who has a tiger by the tail, a real revolution, is strangely silent. Don't get me involved in this. And I'm very distressed about that.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the concluding segment in a series of conversations about the historical origins of social unrest in the modern world. My guests were Jerry Levin and Sis Levin. Jerry Levin served as bureau chief of the cable news network in Beirut, where he was kidnapped and held hostage for 11 months. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Social Unrest in the Middle East, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about the life and work of the American painter Marsden Hartley. My guest will be Townsend Luddington of the University of North Carolina and Thomas Gitkins of the Free University of Berlin. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for a discussion about political captivity in the Middle East. Wayne's guests are Jerry Levin and Sis Levin. Jerry Levin of the Cable News Network was a political hostage in Lebanon for 11 months, making his way to freedom through the lobbying of his wife with American and Middle Eastern officials. Forgotten Hostages: Some Answers and Insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.